Hi, I'm Steve Kenson of Green Running Publishing. You're listening to The Tome Show.
To The Tome, episode 66. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we will be adventuring on with the 4th edition Player's Handbook. That's right, it's time to get the official Tome review of the 4th edition Player's Handbook out there for all of you to hear. William Paul, who brought us the first glance review of the core books, joins me in this episode as the two of us take a more in-depth look at the Player's Handbook for 4th edition. Tomorrow, that's Tuesday the 24th of June 2008, I will be releasing our look at the Dungeon Master's Guide and Monster Manual. So keep your ears open for that, and don't forget to check out the Tome's Amazon store at thetomeshow.com to pick up those 4th edition books if you haven't yet. Then I'm off to Origins, where I will be bringing you all sorts of stuff. But the other big announcement. As of the release of this episode, the Tome's Summer 2008 contest is on. From the time you hear this to the end of August 2008, you can enter the contest to be entered for a drawing for one of three prize packages. Some of the information on the prizes is still coming in. But I can tell you that the prizes will be coming from such prestigious companies as Q Workshop, Swords Edge Publishing, Pulp Gamer, Goodman Games, Green Ronin Publishing, Paizo Publishing, and High Moon Media Productions. And entering this year is going to be really easy. Go to the website, click on the link that says Contest, and then click on the link for the survey at the top. The survey is only 5 questions long, and it's simply there to help me get a better view of my audience, so I can make the Tome the best fit for its listeners. So head over to thetomeshow.com and find out more. Well, time for me to send you off to hear about the 4th edition Player's Handbook. Enjoy! Okay, I am here today with William Paul. We are going to be taking an extensive look at the 4th edition core rulebooks. William was with us before and gave us the first look. He got some early copies and gave us a first look at his sort of first impressions of the books. We've had a little bit more time with him. We've both sort of mulled over them and pointed out in our heads some things that we liked and may have to think more deeply on. But I wanted to start off by saying that it was very nice in all of the books, they managed to have the time to get a dedication in at the beginning of each of the books in memory of E. Gary Gygax. Gary is one of two people who invented the game of D&D, and he recently died. If you follow the blog part of the show, then you knew this because I already had a written piece about the subject posted when it happened. But we haven't really discussed it here on the show before, so I just wanted to take a moment to remember Gary and respectfully acknowledge that none of this would be possible without him. So with that, we are going to go ahead and jump right into talking about the three core books for 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons. This will be probably the last big what's 4E going to be sort of episode before we get into more of a regular routine of looking at some of the books that come out dealing with 4th edition and some other D&D based products like Pathfinder or True 20. And depending on what happens, we'll see what happens with the 3rd edition products also out there. So don't expect those things to go away, but it's going to be nice to be able to get back into a normal routine for the show. Let's start with the Player's Handbook.
Okay.
It is, I believe, the most beloved of D&D volumes. The first thing that comes to mind when I look at the new Player's Handbook is that they've changed the color scheme on me. It's not a big deal, and I know I'm going to get used to it, but more than once, as I've been planning my 4th edition campaign, I've reached for the DMG and instinctively grabbed the blue book. which is now the Player's Handbook.
I didn't even notice that in regard to the Player's Handbook being blue. I thought you're in reference to the fact that the entire art scheme, the entire art for 4th edition is so drastic from 3rd edition. But, you know, I was thinking, well, the art from 2nd edition to 3rd edition was just as drastic. So I really don't have a problem with the differences. But do you see your point about the being blue as opposed to red? But,
well, and give it a few weeks even, and I'll be completely used to it, and it won't be an issue. It's just something.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And as far as the artwork goes, I think the change in art style is less drastic for 4th edition than it was for 3rd. I think the change from 2nd to 3rd had a lot bigger of an art change than the change from 3rd to 4th.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the art is very reminiscent and very much the kind of things that you would expect to see in 3rd edition products. One of the things that I'm looking up art people in it. Yeah, that's what I thought. One of the artists on the cover that you'll see for all the books was Wayne Reynolds, who's done a lot of work for 3rd edition products. He's done a lot of work for Paizo products. So I don't think you're going to see a huge dramatic change compared to some of the things that you've already been seeing in the last few years. I think the artwork change has been more evolutionary. It's sort of been gradual over time. But let's go ahead and jump into the contents of the book. It opens up with a section on how to roleplay and how to use the core mechanic of the game. While it seems to be intended for new gamers, I think it's not a bad idea to read through it once before you play 4th edition for the first time. Just because there's a lot of changes to 4th edition, even some things with the core mechanic are a little bit different. So I think going through this section just to sort of get the gist of some of the changes is not necessarily a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
If nothing else, the idea that most of the rolls that you're making are, it used to be a d20 plus a modifier, usually plus an ability modifier on top of that, whereas now that modifier is now based more on level. A lot of the checks that you're going to make now are D20 plus ability modifier plus half your level. Seems to be sort of the norm.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just, you know, suggesting one read-through, at least, even for experienced gamers, it's one more time that they've looked through the basic common sense elements of the game, which there might be something that has changed. One thing that, you know, people could immediately assume is, you know, I'm just looking here under where they're explaining the core mechanic, and it says always round down. If, like, you're taking half your level or, you know, halving something, then you know it's assumed that, you know, round down or round up depending on what the fraction is. And, you know, it's might be something that people overlook, and then, you know, it causes a, yeah, it causes a lag during actual play.
Sure.
And so, you know, just doing a once-over, as you suggest, you know, really, I don't see how that would be a problem or shouldn't be recommended for even experienced gamers.
Yeah, and as somebody who's been playing the game for 20 years, reading through some of these things that are normally introductory sort of things that I would normally just skim over, because of the podcast, I've done a lot more thorough of a reading, and I'm finding that as I plan my first 4th edition campaign, I'm getting a lot of ideas that I may not have gotten, and I'm following a lot of the advice that sort of seems like no-brainers, and it's certainly things that I've heard before, but you sort of forget about all that great advice you've heard over the years. And so getting that refresher and getting some new ideas into your head isn't always a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
It then moves into making characters. Personally, I love the point buy system. I've been using it in 3rd edition for a while now. The standard array specifically works fine, but I think it works even better when you combine it with the secondary arrays that are already given. where basically they just give you a row of numbers and say pick one of these rows and then arrange them in your stats the way you want to. I think that's a great way to speed up the process of creating a character. You eliminate some of the negatives of randomness. You know, you're not going to have your character that has three crappy stats because it's all well balanced, you know, and your character is going to be just as powerful as the other person's character. You're not going to feel like a second-rate character. And at the same time, with all the different arrays they give you and the various ways to arrange them and adding in your racial features and all that kind of stuff, I think you can get a really unique character build that doesn't look like all the other character builds. I was actually very impressed with the way the variety became possible with those arrays, which was one of my concerns beforehand. I'm not entirely sure what I think about the idea of retraining, which they bring up in that first or in that second section here. It makes sense, I guess, in game terms of trying to make the coolest character, you know, saying I'm no longer trained in this feat, but I'm now trained in this one, or I'm no longer trained in this power, but I'm trained in this power at certain levels. Makes sense in terms of making the coolest character possible, but I have a really hard time suspending my disbelief that you can learn a skill and then unteach it to yourself later.
The thought I've always had in regard to retraining, and once, you know, in 3.5, when the Player's Handbook 2 came out with its retraining rules and such, it instantly clicked in my head as, okay, so you're playing your 3.5 game, or you're playing your fourth edition game now, and you have your abilities selected and such, and then a new source book comes along, and you see an option in that book that, you know, hey, if this book had been out when we started this campaign, then I would have taken that instead of what I did take. So under that situation, I find retraining is a fantastic option.
Yeah, and I've actually done that without specific retraining rules, just with my DM and say, hey, this book came out and this feat matches the flavor of my character a lot better than that one. Do you mind if I switch? And that I don't have an issue with. But there's very specific rules in this 4th edition Player's Handbook that says when you reach these levels, you can retrain these powers and get rid of these powers and add in the new ones and that kind of stuff. I think the idea behind it is they don't want to run into the problem where you have a million different powers, you know? So you don't have a character sheet that's 7 pages long to keep track of all the different things you can do. They want to keep it relatively simple, but allow you to upgrade your powers to things that are more useful at higher level.
That I guess I can see what they might be trying to do with that, but I don't see where there would be a problem with having a character sheet that's 7 pages long.
Well, yeah. On one hand, as a game mechanic, I completely agree with him. I'd rather have it be simple. But as a person who wants things to make sense in the world that I'm creating, unlearning things that you previously knew, it stretches my disbelief a little bit.
And it could – the justification for it, it might be that it's not just – or it might be that – it's not that your character doesn't know the skill anymore or know the power anymore. It's just that it's not – they're not going to be actively focusing on it. And so it's just, you know, sit on the back burner in the mind, yeah, so to speak.
I suppose technically it's still there, but why bother bringing it out when you can – or even bother putting it on your character sheet when you have something else that's more useful and better?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I suppose you can sort of justify it that way, that you still know it. It's you just don't use it anymore because that's a beginner tactic and now you're more advanced. I suppose that works. This is also the part of the Player's Handbook where they introduce the three tiers of play: heroic, paragon, and epic. These tiers play into characters, they play into powers, they play into monsters, NPCs, traps, pretty much everything in the game. So you better get used to the three tiers of play if you're going to be playing 4th edition, because I don't think they're going anywhere.
And I think that the tier system is quite good, because I've been in games before where we started off at first level, and the scope of the game is it would have been in just the heroic tier. And by the time the primary story arc, the primary campaign plot ended that the DM was running, we were pretty much at level 10, level 11, and it would have been a good stopping point to say, okay, we've reached the end of the heroic tier. We can, you know, roll new characters, start a new campaign, play a different game. But since conceptually we didn't have that idea, we just kept dragging the game on for a couple sessions where it really hindered the game more than anything else. Where if we had the focus of, okay, this is just going to be a heroic tier game, then we would have been able to get more enjoyment out of those sessions where we were in that actual setting.
Sure.
I'm not sure if I'm getting my point across
I think you're right. I think the tiers add a whole new level of focus to the game and help a DM, if nothing else, focus on what kind of things that their game maybe should be doing. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I think in a year we're going to have a very different perspective on what 4th edition is like, because we'll have had a lot more experience playing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is one of those things. They did, since you talked about the heroic tier, they did try to make the heroic tier a bit more survivable at early levels.
Mm-hmm.
Hit points are calculated completely differently, where it's now a certain number plus your con score for first level. And so, you know, a wizard with 20 or 30 hit points at first level is the norm.
And all first level characters are clearly heroic.
Yes.
Emphasis on that word heroic.
Yes.
Which, and of course, we might be jumping the gun a little bit here talking about classes and such, but I don't know if I necessarily like that. The reason being is that how did your character transition from just being your everyday ordinary guy to being heroic?
Right. I'm kind of curious to see how that's going to play out in the games that I'm running and that I'm playing in, just because I always made it a point to sort of explain how a character got to the point that they're at, you know, in my background and that kind of stuff. And it's going to be tough to explain how Farmer Jim suddenly became a PC and gained, you know, 30 hit points in the process.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to be able to see mechanically how that transition would occur.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see, you know, either non-heroic PC rules or level zero rules, so to speak.
Yeah.
Just to see how, you know, how they would mesh with what's in these core books.
Sure. Then it talks about races. I like a lot of the new additions to the races. I like how races work. There's no longer any penalties for being a certain race anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Only bonuses. Which is sort of, you know, it sort of all washes out in the end, doesn't it? So that's not a huge deal. But being a different race gives you different abilities that I think are going to continue being useful throughout gameplay. You know, a lot of the abilities from 3rd edition were interesting and useful maybe in certain really rare situations. You know, like you happen to be fighting a giant. Or there happens to be a burrowing creature nearby, or whatever the case may be. But then sort of lost their pizzazz as you got up in more powerful levels.
Mm-hmm.
I think the abilities are going to be more useful throughout the game at the way they've designed them now. I really like that they changed the way movement works for each of the races. You know, it used to be that everything was either 20 or 30 feet, which would translate to either 4 squares or 6 squares. Now, some races move a little faster. You might have a race that has 7 squares, you know, 35 feet. You might have some that move a little slower, but most of them are right around that middle section. But there's a little bit more variety in speeds, and I like that some of them actually go a little bit above that normal 30 feet or 6 square range. I thought it was interesting and worth noting that of the 8 races, almost half of them are elves. You've got the Eladrin, which are, you know, otherworldly elves from another plane. You've got the half elves. You've got the elves themselves. That means 3 out of the 8 races are elven.
I never looked at it that way, but yeah, I guess you're right.
It just sort of dawned on me kind of funny that way. It's like, well, I normally don't see that many elven-based characters, and yet almost half the races are elven.
And you've also got to remember that in the back of the Monster Manual, they have stats for drow characters too.
That's true.
So that's
and we'll talk about that more when we get to the Monster Manual. But yeah, you've got a lot of elves out there. So, anything else on races?
Not that I can think of. I know that. I mean, of course, as you were saying, that the racial abilities do increase as levels go up. You know, for example, the just the new race Dragonborn. You know, that start off at first level with a breath weapon, and as you proceed up through the tiers, the breath weapon gets more powerful. It scales itself along with the characters. And so that's just that is just an example of, you know, going in a little bit more detailed than as you were saying. So
yeah, and you can do a lot more with those races also through the feat structure, because there's a lot more emphasis on racial feats than there was in third edition. And so you can make your elf be more elven as you go through because of all the different feats that you take. So next up then is the big chapter on classes. A lot of what we learned about the game ahead of time sort of revolved around classes. It's sort of a central mechanic to Dungeons & Dragons and has been since first edition. Fourth edition seems to really go out of their way to make it more important than it has been for several editions now. I sort of wish the chart for gaining levels was in the class section. So when I wanted to level my character, I could just open the class section and do it all right there. It's actually in Chapter 2 in the section about how to make characters.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'll get used to that. I just sort of wish all of that was in one place. So when it's time to gain a level, I could find everything in one place. But that's just not going to be the case, is it?
Not for they might do that for Player's Handbook 2 next year.
Maybe, yeah. But of course, the Player's Handbook 2 is going to have all kinds of different stuff in it. So they've added the idea of Paragon paths to the game, sort of to replace Prestige classes. Prestige classes were always a way to add a level of flavor and specialization to your character. Paragon paths do the same thing. When you reach that Paragon tier, which is above level 10, then you pick a Paragon path, and it allows you to add certain specialization and flavor to your character. But you continue on in the same class that you were in before. You're just adding on more abilities. So you've got your normal fighter abilities, plus you've got the extra Paragon path abilities that you're gaining to show that you're not just a fighter, you're a special kind of fighter. And they sort of do the same thing for the Epic tier with something called Epic Destinies. The difference here being is that with Paragon Paths, there is a handful of Paragon Paths for each class. For Epic Destinies, there's just a handful of Epic Destinies, and you can take them and apply them to any class. So you could be a fighter who's going to become immortal, or you could be a wizard who's going to be immortal, just as you could be a fighter who's going to become a demigod, or a wizard that's going to become a demigod.
And the one thing that just popped into my head as I was reading through the description of Paragon Paths, Epic Destinies, is this is an area that is just ripe for expansion.
Oh yeah,
you know there's going to be source books that will have new Paragon Paths, new Epic Destinies, and I think just recently on the Wizards of the Coast website, they have, as part of their Dragon, the latest issue of Dragon on their website, one of the articles has a new Warlord Paragon Path.
Right. I think Paragon Paths are going to be just like Prestige Classes in 3rd Edition, where every new book is going to have a few.
Hopefully not every new book. I really can't see, what is it, the item book, treasure something or other in the name that's going to be coming out for in a couple months. I hope Paragon Paths don't show up too much in that, because I don't know what type of Paragon Paths would show up in a
special
treasure catalog.
There's going to be a special crafter class. They're going to bring the artificer in and then have Paragon Paths for the artificer to explain all these new items.
Okay.
I don't know. That's wild speculation.
Wild speculation. Okay.
Right. it gets into skills. Skills are much more simplified. The list of skills is a lot smaller. And basically you're either trained in it or you're not. There's no more skill points to deal with. Like a lot of things, it's just you roll a d20, you add an ability modifier, you add your half your level, and then you add a +5 if you're trained in it, or you don't add a +5 if you're not trained in it.
Skills, it might just be because I'm so used to 3.5 still, but it just seems like, yes, the condensed skill list, I do like that, but it just seems like it just seems too short. Where's the performance skill for all those wannabe bard characters?
I have very similar thoughts on the skills. I really like the idea of consolidating the skills into a smaller list. I really like the idea of athletics instead of separate jump and climb and all that. I really like the idea of acrobatics. I really like the idea of stealth. I like the idea of taking these collections of skills and combining them into just a few skills. But you're right. I think there's some of them that they missed. And I think I'm going to miss the complexity that came with skill points. As much as I'd like to see the game simplified, I think skill points is one of those things where it was made things more complex in a good way, because it was only complex in creation. You know, when you're making the character, there was a little bit of complexity because you had to do a lot of simple math to add and subtract more ranks or whatever. But in terms of playing the game, once the character was done, there wasn't any more complexity. It was still just a plus whatever or a minus whatever, which isn't any different than what it is now. So that's a bit of complexity I think I'm going to miss. I think I like the old skill system a little bit better, just because I like skill points, and I'd like it if there were a few of those skills that got the boot. I wish they hadn't gotten the boot.
You could condense all the various crafting skills into one crafting skill.
Right.
But, maybe they're holding off for, you know, that and, you know, the performance skill for when they do release the Bard class.
Yeah, I suppose. I would sort of prefer they just give us all the skills now, because I always hate tacking on new skills later on. You had to do a little bit of that with some of the books from 3rd edition, and that was always just sort of annoying because, you know, my character sheet is already done. Okay, so that's skills in a nutshell. And let's just go ahead and talk feats now.
Okay.
Feats seem to work pretty much exactly like you would remember from 3rd edition. There are a few exceptions. We mentioned that there's more racial feats now. There's also this new thing called multiclassing feats, which is the 4th edition answer to multiclassing. It's no more taking a level in another class. Now you take a feat that lets you sort of take a small sampling of powers from another class in exchange for your normal power. Okay, so in some ways I really like this idea. I like the idea of having a character that can sort of dabble in another class. On the other hand, I like the idea of a character who can triple class. I like the idea of a character who can evenly split classes between, you know, fighter and wizard, or wizard and cleric, or whatever it is. And you can't do that anymore. You can't have an even split. In fairness, I don't think I really used those ideas very much in game. But I like the idea that they were out there, that you could do.
Well, now, is there really anything that says that you can't pick up multiple multi-class feats?
I believe the rules very specifically say that you can't. Let me double check. But I'm pretty sure it says...
Okay, wait. Yeah, it looks like I see that right
here. There's two restrictions for class-specific multi-class feats. First, you can take one... You can't take one from your own class. And second, once you take a multi-class feat, you can't take a class-specific feat from a different class. So you can dabble in a second class, but you can't dabble in a third.
Well, but then another way that you can multi-class, I think, is that once you get to level 11 with your Paragon path choice, you would actually be able to choose another one of the base classes as your Paragon path, as opposed to a Paragon path.
Oh, is there a rules for that? I didn't see that.
And then I think it's...
You're talking about how if you have a multi-class feat...
Okay.
If you say I'm a fighter with the multi-class wizard feat, then I could choose a wizard paragon path for my character. I do remember seeing that. Paragon multi-classing, yeah.
Okay.
And so that would be able to allow you to add a little bit more of that flavor. And I think what this is going to do is it's going to open up the door for wizards to put out more books with more classes that sort of do this kind of thing anyway. For example, I was just talking to Richard Baker from Wizards the other day for an interview that we did for the book Sword Mage. He mentioned that Sword Mage is going to be a full-blown class that comes out. I'm thinking in the Forgotten Realms book, but it might be in another book. I don't know if that said for sure.
That is what I'd heard, is that that's going to be in the Forgotten Realms books.
Right. And so that's going to be a class that, having read the novel, is, I think, going to be very much a fighter-wizard combination. And so you're going to just have a class that gives you fighter-wizard-like combinations. So I think they're going to, instead of having you multi-class a lot to make interesting combinations, I think they're instead going to try to just make more classes to try to create those combinations that way.
Okay. Now... Was, I mean, I don't know if you got into much of the crunch aspect of, his work, but with the classes each having their being in a role, your fighters being defenders, wizards being controllers, did he specify one way or another, or could you tell from your reading of the book whether that sword mage would fall into?
It didn't come up in conversation. Thinking about it, I'm guessing that the sword mage is probably a striker. Because he was definitely played as a sort of rush forward and stab people with your sword and or magic sort of character.
Okay.
And has certain abilities, certain like teleportation abilities and that kind of stuff, to allow easier movement to get into the front lines and that kind of thing. So that would be my guess.
Okay.
Now, how they fit that into a power source, I'm not sure, because then in that kind of a class, I would imagine some of the powers are arcane and some of the powers are martial.
And as far as we know, we haven't heard anything about a dual-sourced
class. Yeah, that would be the first time we'd heard about that.
But that it will definitely be interesting to see once that comes out. But since we're dealing just with the books that we have right now,
yeah. So I suppose let's go on with the books that we have. Next up, they talk about equipment, which is pretty much exactly what you would expect, except now they've added in magic items in the player's book. I actually really like that. I like that they've put the magic items in the player's handbook to try to focus things. You know, you don't, if you want to be a player in the game, you don't need to go out and buy all the books now. I very much feel like I could pick up the Player's Handbook and be a player in a game. At the same time, I definitely feel like having the Dungeon Master's Guide is useful to me if I'm going to be a Dungeon Master. I also like how they've taken some of the more mundane gear and they've lumped it together. Like they have an adventure pack. I don't know if that's the name they use for it, but it's just sort of, this is the standard equipment that an adventurer would get. Mm-hmm. You can just pay a certain price and get those things, and you don't have to go through and get everything a la carte.
Looks like the it says a standard adventurer's kit.
Kit, there you go.
But yeah, that is nice. It has one-stop shopping, so to speak.
Yeah. And I think they started to sort of go along that route with third edition when they introduced things like the climber's kit. You know, rather than making you buy all the individual items a la carte, they just said, you know what, get a climber's kit and it'll give you a stock bonus or whatever. So I think they sort of have taken that to the next logical conclusion and introduced the standard adventurer's kit, which is honestly something I'd been doing in my third edition games for 6 years now, 7 years now. So
that is one thing that I've noticed about fourth edition in general, these three books, is they took a lot of stuff that they saw most people were using as house rules and just said, okay, everyone does it anyway. Let's just make it official in the core books, listed as something in the books. And of course, just like anything in any D&D book, any role play game book, people can choose to ignore it and make up their own house rules for it. But for people that may or may not have thought of that particular variation, the fact that it's listed in the rule book now, it makes first-time gamers, first-time DMs, makes it easier for them.
Yeah, and interestingly, the DMG, and we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves, but the DMG actually has a section on how to use house rules and change the game. You know, you don't normally see a book that says, and by the way, if you want to not use our rules, here's some advice on making your own and changing it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was interesting. Further on in equipment, I found the changes to things like potions and specifically healing potions to be interesting. No more does a potion simply heal you a certain amount. Instead, it gives you a healing surge, which is a mechanic we didn't really talk about earlier, but basically allows you to heal a certain amount based on your class.
And now, does it say with the potions that you actually use a healing surge, or do you get a number of hit points back based on your healing surge amount, your healing surge value?
That's a good question.
Because that would actually... that could actually be a good specification between two healing potions. If you have one that uses your healing surge and one that just heals equal to your healing surge, obviously, you know, for adventurers, that could be a vast difference in regard to what they're paying for if they're buying either one of those two items.
Sure. I'm looking through all the potions, and with the exception of the Potion of Life, which brings you back from the dead, all of them say drink the potion and spend a healing surge. So you would you actually have to use a healing surge in order to drink any of the potions.
Okay.
So that also actually interestingly limits the amount of healing that you could do. You can't just down healing potions until you're at max. You can only down them as long as you have healing surges. And that also means the potions aren't particularly useful outside of combat. Because outside of combat, you can use as many healing surges as you want anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The places where potions are going to be useful is if you're in the middle of a fight and you're about to die, you're only allowed to use healing surges a certain number of times, usually once in a combat, as part of an action called a second wind. So this is going to be a way to allow you to use that more often without having to rely on your cleric or your warlord or whatever to allow you to use healing surges.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting, because everything, all healing seems to be very much based around this concept of the healing surge.
Well, now, would, and I guess we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves again, but does using a healing surge, drinking a potion, would that provoke an opportunity attack?
I don't know specifically. My guess would be yes, but that might be because my gut is still largely rooted in third edition.
And we can definitely check on that as we go through the combat chapter.
Right.
But
we'll have to check on that. But yeah, but it's definitely that. I mean, it definitely narrows down the focus of what a potion can be used for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a potion before could be used to hold any spell. Now they're all healing. There's only four different kinds of potions, and they only allow you to. They're only really useful in combat using the healing that you naturally have anyway.
And so it's going to be interesting to see what other potions are in future source books.
Yeah, that's true.
If there are going to be, you know, your bull strength, cat's grace, eagle splendor type potions.
That's a good point, because actually, as I think about it, now that we go in going back to Sword Mage, there's a part in that novel where it is mentioned that a character might have taken a potion of invisibility, which is a potion that currently does not exist.
That would definitely be interesting to. I can't see it being very. I can't see it being very hard to write up the fourth edition crunch for a potion of invisibility.
Right.
Because basically, it would just be you take it, and then you get the effects of. I'm sure there are powers that provide invisibility.
Yeah, there are.
As you know, and so basically, you get the effect of that particular power once you drink the potion.
Yeah, and I just quickly. Glanced at the opportunity attack section, and it does not look like drinking a potion provokes an attack.
Interesting.
Moving provokes, ranged and area powers provoke, and that's it. So drinking a potion would not be any of those.
So I can just see your defenders out there pulling aggro, and as they're getting beat upon. They just have a bandolier of healing potions, you know, strapped across their chest, and they just grab one, as a move action or probably standard action, but just take the potion and just keep on going.
Right. Now, the area where the potions are different than healing surges is they actually heal you a certain amount of damage. It's no longer rolling a d8 and adding one, but it's drink the potion, spend a healing surge, but instead of getting your normal healing surge hit points back, you get 10 back, or 25 back, or 50 back, depending on which one you take.
And of course, the, you know, the crux of that is, okay, so at the lower levels, you may have a healing potion that, since the potion does a set amount, that set amount is more than what your healing surge would be.
Right, I think that's
but
the
then,
idea.
As you increase in level, the value that you can heal from your healing surge increases.
Oh, sure. So that means you got to make sure you're getting the potions that are the right level, because, of course, all magic items also have levels now to show you whether they're appropriate for your character.
So these potions would be use them or lose them.
Right. Definitely. Okay, well, that takes us into a chapter on adventuring. Which honestly I think is interesting to look at and good to read to understand the game, but I think it's going to be one of those chapters that once you understand the game is not going to be opened very much.
I think the DMG equivalent chapter has a whole lot more details.
Yes.
A lot of more information, which of course this type of chapter, it is the Dungeon Master's realm.
Right. I think this chapter actually has more things that a DM is going to be looking at on a regular basis than a player is.
And I mean,
you know, because it's got your overland speed. If you have a speed of 6 squares, then this is how fast per day your characters are going to go. Or if you're, you know, this is your distance modifier for this kind of terrain, or this is the break DC of that wooden door. These are all look like things that I would be looking up as a DM, but I wouldn't be looking up as a player.
And I definitely agree with you. And I know that, let's see, what I remember from the Dungeon Master Guide, the equivalent chapter there pretty much has the same information, just in greater detail.
Sure.
So.
Well, and honestly, I don't remember seeing some of that stuff in the DMG, like the break DCs and a light radius and that kind of stuff. I think maybe this chapter, or at least half of this chapter, seems like it would have been better suited to the DMG. But I suppose if you're a DM and you want to make the characters track what is their light source, and I suppose I could see doing that and putting that responsibility on the players too. So that's fine. It's only a few pages, honestly. It's the shortest chapter of the book, and probably not a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
The next chapter, though, deals with combat, and is a pretty lengthy and detailed chapter. They do a really nice job of giving you the things that you need to know to run a fight in D&D. I kind of wish they had included some more things in the player's handbook about the non-combat encounters, like skill challenges and that kind of stuff. But I guess this just sort of proves that D&D is still mostly a game about going out and killing things. So things like skill challenges just didn't seem to make the cut into the player's handbook.
Well, I do remember that there is a small section in the player's handbook where it describes what skill challenges are and what players should expect from them. But of course, the real details of what a skill challenge is, how to run them, you know, what's involved with them is all in the DMG.
Right. And we'll talk about that in more detail as we get into the DMG too.
Mm-hmm.
But the things in the combat section, I mean, it's lengthy and it's detailed, and there's lots of sidebars and lots of little boxes with, you know, that it's separated out to give you lots of information. I don't particularly want to spend tons of time just going through all the stuff that's in the combat section, but it is a well-developed section on combat. And if you want to know how something's going to work, you have one chapter to look at to find those rules. And that's actually going to be very convenient to not have to skip around to different parts of the book to try to figure out what you're looking for.
And I believe that this chapter is probably going to be, during play, the most referenced chapter. I would expect during character creation, possibly race and class chapters, but once you actually get into playing the game, this is the chapter to have dog-eared. This is the chapter to have bookmarked.
I would say this chapter and the classes chapter, because that's where all the powers are detailed. So you're going to be looking up your powers as you use them. That's my gut, is those two sections are going to be used a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last, last chapter, is on rituals. These are basically your non-combat spells for 4th edition. They take longer to cast. They have costly components, and it costs money and resources to research them, to learn them to begin with. So basically, to use them, you have to use more time and you have to spend money. Which sometimes makes a lot of sense and sometimes is a little harder to make sense of. But it's an interesting approach to the spellcasting system nonetheless. I'm sort of eager to see how this system plays out more than any of the other systems. Because basically, you can cast these spells as much as you want. You know, you can sit there and cast this spell 1,000 times a day, except that you're limited by how much money you have.
Mm-hmm.
The other interesting bit that I'm sort of anxious to see how it plays out in the game is the part where this is the part of the game where scrolls come back in, because scrolls don't show up under magic items, but scrolls are important to rituals, because you can put a ritual on a scroll, and once you do that, anybody can use it. You know, your fighter could pick up the scroll and cast view object or planar portal or discern lies or whatever off of that scroll. So I think that's going to be interesting to see how that sort of plays out.
And that will, I agree with you, be interesting because it's, yeah, as you said, your fighter that has no magical aptitude at all would be able to pick up the scroll and use whatever whatever spells are on the scroll. I think the actual mechanics for rituals are going to be interesting because I believe I have noticed online where there have been some thoughts of taking the ritual system and using it for other things. Taking the ritual system and using it for as a basis for a crafting mechanic.
Right, and there's some of that groundwork already laid because they have some rituals like brew potion and that kind of stuff. So I think rituals are going to be something to sort of keep your eye on. It's either a system that's going to be really interesting and really neat, or it's going to be a system that ends up house ruled a lot. I think that's going to be one of the key areas to sort of watch to see if it works or not.
And that, yeah, of course, I would really expect, I would be surprised if there aren't in future source books, just like Paragon Paths, more and more rituals that are included in those books.
Oh, sure. Anytime you would normally see new spells in older, you know, in previous editions, I think you're going to see more rituals show up. And then, of course, they finish it off with the standard character sheet and an index. I find the index a little bit lacking. I find this to be sort of true of all the books. I think the index, I think having a great index and a great glossary in these books is a huge part of making the books more useful because then you can find what you want to find more quickly. I guess they just sort of want everybody to use D&D Insider because that's going to make it really easy to find stuff in your books. But all in all, I think the book is good. I think the rules for the whole game that are presented in the player's handbook sound like a lot of fun. I look forward to testing them out. And I think in the next year or two, as people play more and more and more of those loopholes sort of get filled and we you know, have gone from hundreds of people playtesting to, you know, thousands of people playing the game, I think we're going to see a lot more information about how things work and how things don't and what needs to be house ruled and what doesn't and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Final thoughts on the player's handbook?
It's a good start. There's more room for more rituals, more feats, more paragon paths, more build options in the classes, and it's going to be really interesting to see what not only Wizards of the Coast comes up with, but the fan community, the third-party publishers, and I just can't wait to see what's released.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with third-party publishers now that the game system license is actually released. That just came out this week. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that.
I have. I can honestly say I'm glad I'm not a third-party publisher at this point, planning to put out fourth edition product.
Yeah.
But for those that are out there to do it, I salute them.
Yeah, I'm glad people are doing it, but I tell you what, the new system license certainly it certainly doesn't seem like Wizards wants people to be publishing D&D stuff besides them.
Now, the one thought that I had in regard to the GSL is that would there be such a reaction to the GSL and what's in it or not in it if the third edition OGL had not been released?
Oh, absolutely not, because second edition was completely closed. You know, until the OGL, D&D was a completely closed game. There was no license for other people to do stuff. It just wasn't heard of. And now this whole industry has sort of sprung up around people making D&D products. And I guess the idea was they didn't want to just outright bankrupt people by saying you can't do your core business anymore, which is making D&D products. But they certainly don't seem to be encouraging it anymore.
I mean, I can understand them not wanting to provide an option for, you know, basically their competition, but it, we're all gamers. We all want to support each other.
Oh, yeah.
And unfortunately, I guess the legal department at Wizards of the Coast is, well, I guess they're not gamers.
And D&D is not competing with really anybody. You know, nobody, there is not a single game out there that's on the level of D&D when it comes to role-playing games. And so I think everybody in the role-playing community would like to see fourth edition Dungeons & Dragons be as awesome of a game as possible, you know?
Oh, definitely.
I read Chris Pramus's blog, Chris Pramus, who runs Green Ronin, and he is a huge proponent of 4th edition D&D being just an incredible game, because the more people play D&D, the more people are playing games in general, you know? D&D is the gateway game for pretty much all other role-playing games.
Definitely.
Almost everybody in gaming played D&D first, unless you're one of those people that played Vampire first.
Or Palladium.
I don't think that's a very common occurrence. I'm sure, and obviously everybody starts with something, but it seems like most people are starting with D&D or Vampire because they're, you know, into goth or into LARP
but
or whatever.
What I was saying in regard to with Wizards of the Coast not wanting to provide support for their competitors is that, especially with 3rd edition, 3.5, games like Iron Heroes, Mutants and Masterminds, Conan, you know, all of those would not have been ever released if it weren't for the OGL. And those are systems that, you know, those are games, products that definitely could be considered as games that are taking away from Wizards of the Coast bottom line if they choose to look at it that way. And so with the GSL, they're just, I mean, I can understand what they're doing of trying to make sure that they don't run into that problem. I would expect they look at it as a problem, you know, in the future with 4th edition.
Sure. But in any case, that is the player's handbook with a bit of a diatribe on the end there about the game system license, which is all kinds of interesting and makes me glad I'm a podcaster and not a publisher. We're going to head off and talk about the Dungeon Master's Guide next, so join us for that. Well, okay, that's the 4th edition Player's Handbook. Now a quick promo from Pulp Gamer. Great guys, great show. You can find me at their booth at Origins from 11 to 3 each day. So if you're going to be at the con, please swing by and it'd be nice to meet you.
Hello, I'm Don Dem.
I'm Derek Rex.
And I'm Jeremiah Lynch.
Every once in a while, we like to let down our hair and go out of character to talk to you, respond to your feedback, and talk about some things we're finding notable about our world.
The world we live in is one of board games, card games, and role-playing games.
We produce several podcasts on such topics, but this is the one that allows us to get open up and freestyle a little bit.
It gets a little crazy sometimes, but we mostly stay on topic.
Come join us at PulpGamer.com. That's P-U-L-P gamer.com. And look for the Out of Character podcast.
Don't forget your dice.
PulpGamer.com.
Well, okay, there's episode 66. And hey, why don't you email the show at thetomeshow@gmail.com and let us know what you think. Or if you agree, disagree, are confused, or think we completely forgot to mention something, hop on over to the forums at thetomeshow.com. Also, you can help the show get noticed with reviews or votes on various sites, but more than that, get out there and tell people about the show. Maybe just mention the show at your regular gaming group and see if anyone else listens. I found out that there's at least one listener of the show in my new group. Hey, Glenn. Also, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. And once again, you can find all of this at thetomeshow.com. And of course, The Tome continues to work with Fistful of Comics and Games and Gamers Haven, so check out those great shows, and you'll find links to their websites in the show notes. This has been episode 66, 4th edition Player's Handbook of... The Tome.